Good afternoon, everybody.
Right, it's coming towards the end of the festival. You've had a good time. You've sampled, Utopia for a couple of days. Feeling good?
Yeah.
Tonight you're going back to the real world, I guess. Any of you checked out the news? Yeah, it's not too good out there at the moment. Luckily, no riots in Oxfordshire, as far as I know, as yet. But there've been 80 last night around the country. Whatever they call themselves, the masters of the human race, have managed to burn down the library in Liverpool. So it's not great. Just to warn you, what you're going back to. So what we thought we'd do is we're going to try and cheer you up in the 20 minutes we've got, that there are better things that could happen than what you are about to see when you go home. And before I dig myself into a hole any further about this, I'm going to hand over to Kate, who's going to tell you about the first of three publications we want to get you interested in. The first one is called, and Kate's going to model it.
I'm his glamorous assistant.
You are. Just stand around, walk around. It's called Act Now. It's unusual because it's a book written. It's not unusual because it's a book. It's unusual because it's a book written by at least 30 people who were all made to agree that they would trust everybody else who was writing it and not have their little names on the little bits that they were happy with, which is what normally happens with these books. So it's a little bit different to your normal The World Could Be a Better Place book. Over to you, Kate.
Well, this book, it tries to be a new beverage report. Has everybody here heard of the beverage report?
Yes!
Who's read the beverage report?
Yes!
A lot of people read it in the 1940s. It was published in 1942. Danny, do you know how many people bought it in the next 2 weeks?
I do not.
600,000 copies.
Wow.
And 92% of the British public knew about the beverage report the day after it was published. 92%. Because we didn't have much television back then, and no social media, so perhaps it was easier to sort of pay attention to what was going on. But this is what we're trying to do with this one. It's trying to be a new beverage report. And then the other thing that we want to talk about today is the spirit level at 15. So 15 years ago, Richard Wilkinson and I, he's my glamorous assistant.
Richard Wilkinson is ably handing out leaflets for you. He's wearing the rather puck-like hat, covered in flowers.
So with his puck-like demeanour.
Yeah.
15 years ago, we published a book showing that inequality damages pretty much everything. And now, 15 years on, we published a report showing that inequality damages pretty much everything and even more, the environment as well. And that's a free report available to download. So we're handing out flyers so that you can access both of those publications, but there's one more.
There's one more about seven children. We'll tell you about that one a little bit later. We really ought to explain these two first. We're sitting here a bit smugly because although what we write about is fairly terrible, is the climate getting worse, is inequality rising, is the effects of inequality, and we've been doing this for a very long time, we've been right. When we've said it is very bad to be an unequal country, the outcomes have been very, very bad. The UK has had the largest increase in child poverty of all of Europe. In fact, of every country the United Nations measured in the most recent assessment that came out in December last year. When we said that another way was possible in 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, people of course didn't go for that, and we got calamity. Calamity that you've never really seen before in this country, if you think about what happened after 2019. It's terrible, but I think you find it hard to say that the situation that we're living with, the highest rate of income inequality in all of Europe, the highest rate of income inequality we've had since the 1930s, is not a problem. Particularly on the weekend, when people are rioting across the country, because they're racist, essentially. Let's just be clear about that. But why do we have this kind of anger in this country? It's because this country is the most divided you will find on this continent. And that doesn't make people happy. And there isn't a way in which you can placate people and tell them just to know their place and it'll all be okay.
Because I've been thinking a lot about what Britain is good at as I've been watching the Olympics. And I was just watching the cricket out here, which was Olympics, America versus Great Britain. And of course, those are the two most unequal countries in all the analysis we do. So if you really want to think about who's number one and who's leading the world, and it's America and Great Britain, they're leading on inequality. But I was thinking back to when we had the Olympics in 2012 and how proud we all were watching that opening ceremony. Do you remember watching people bouncing on the beds and the nurses, and we were celebrating the NHS, you know, and we all felt really proud of that. And then I was thinking about Alan Bennett and what he said when he was asked in 2015, what are the English really good at? What's our number one accomplishment? And he said hypocrisy. And I thought that was spot on, really, because we go around thinking we're proud to be British because of the NHS, and we're proud because of various things that we do, and then we stop doing them. Or we reverse them, or we undermine them. And now look at us, with all the problems we've got today. So yeah, I think we're number one for hypocrisy.
You're right, we've got to try and lift you a little bit from this, but it's... But it is worth accepting that we have got things very wrong, and we tell very bad stories about ourselves and our wonderful history and what a great place we are and what wonderful things we did for the rest of the world. We're growing up to that now. You barely hear, outside of, you know, really ancient oak-lined offices in universities that are very stuffy, you rarely hear people go on about the wonders of the British Empire anymore. We're learning. Things are getting better, but to get better, they first of all have to get a bit worse. You have to accept that your glorious history wasn't so good. You may have to peak at the highest level of inequality in the whole of the continent. You want some good news? In the last couple of years, for the first time since the 1930s, wage inequalities have fallen. The gaps between the rich and the poor have gone down because the deals that have been made on wages have almost all been progressive. You take the civil service, top civil servants have had a 25% reduction in their income since 2008. Middle ranking civil servants, only a 12% reduction. That's a reduction in inequality. But you're all worse off. Take the private sector. Take British Telecom. 2019, they had a union deal across the board. Everybody got 3%. Now, if you're an older, normally male, telephone engineer, you're on the highest salary. 3% is bigger than everybody else's 3%. Right? Those flat deals increase absolute inequality. The latest agreement to the transport of the Communication Workers Union is incredibly complicated and tiered. The lowest paid people have had the biggest increase in their incomes, because otherwise they'd start to starve. 56% of children in England who've got a brother and a sister are going hungry now several times a month. The actual uplift in benefits was bigger than the average uplift in wages, because it had to be, because inflation was even higher. Prices are still 25 to 30% higher than they were 2 years ago. But as all this happens, we're beginning to get, possibly, for the first time in my lifetime, a narrowing of the gap. House prices in real terms have fallen compared to wages, because they've had to go up less than inflation, but the house prices haven't. That's a reduction in wealth inequality. It doesn't necessarily feel good. Particularly, I've had to get one jibe in. This is the only place where Kate and I can sort of feel comfortable because we are you. You know, we are well-off people, well-off enough to come to a festival like this. If you're well-off, if you can afford to come to Wilderness, reductions in income and wealth inequalities don't necessarily feel like a good thing. Because it's going to be that we and you are going to have less. That's the only way it's possible. We're not suddenly going to find a way of inventing gold out of nothing and making the entire country suddenly rich. It's going to be belt-tightening time for decades to come. But that is not a bad thing. People who live in more equal countries in this continent are happier, more secure, mix more easily, don't worry so much about exactly where they live, don't worry about where their children go to school. Imagine that. There's only one other country in the world that spends as much as we do on private schooling. That's Chile. Do you know what happened in Chile in 2019? It all blew up. Okay, it's not as safe position to be a very unequal country. There are only two countries in Europe, by the way, where they wear school uniform like we do. Anybody want to guess? Where else do they wear school uniforms routinely?
Tunisia.
Tunisia, no, in Europe. Ireland is one, British influence. The second British influence is a clue. Small country. Malta. Ireland and Malta. Okay, there are all kinds of things that we think are very normal, like dressing our children in weird clothes, which don't happen in the rest of this continent. And amazingly, they have discipline in their schools without that being necessary. There are all kinds of things that can be different. We're about to find this out because we've become much poorer and we're just about beginning to become more equal.
Right. So do you think we can all do a better job than the government of coming up with some principles on which to base policy? Yes. Do you want to suggest one?
I think we should raise taxes personally.
Raise taxes. Okay. I'll take that. What else? How about principles on which all policies should be based, including a taxation? Distribution of wealth. Right, should we try and get things to be more equal? That's a good one. You're agreeing. Okay. Yeah. If you don't have an address. Yeah. Okay.
Every policy, you think about how does this affect the woman behind the till in ASDA or the man in the white hat?
Very nice. That's a little bit like the socioeconomic duty, which was part of the Equality Act in 2010 that never got enacted. But it's there, it could be put into place. Stroke of a pen, because it's already there. Anyone else? How about this side of the room? Yeah.
Means testing.
Means testing. What do you want to means test?
People's ability to
four different things. Okay.
Testing on the basis of salary and then looking at that as a proportion of what people should be taxed and then making it less progressive and more progressive.
Alright, so we're back onto progressive taxation. I've got one down here.
Improving productivity.
Impact on climate.
Yeah.
Generational fairness.
Intergenerational fairness. These are pretty good.
Yeah.
So what we came up with in our book were five principles which should underpin all policymaking. And the first is more equal distribution of resources, more equality. Everything that government does should improve equality. The second was, no, I don't have to look at my phone.
Oh, you've memorised them.
I've memorised them. Is we really should improve people's freedom. And what we mean by that is freedom from oppression. Freedom from practicing a shit job behind the till. So every policy that's put in place should enhance people's freedom to be free of oppression. And the third is that we should act on the social determinants of health. All of the things that make us healthier in mind and body. And that would include a lot of the things you've talked about. So reducing poverty, improving people's wages. And then the fourth was we thought we should improve community wealth. Not the wealth of the top 1%, or even smaller, or even the wealth of people like us. But we should improve wealth in communities, and we should keep it there in communities. And the fifth was that we should improve quality between places. So that we shouldn't just live in a country where everything sort of sucks down to London and the South East, but we improve things for people all over the country. So those are the five all new policies should do.
Okay, we're going to go to questions in about 4 minutes. Do you get enough time to have a go with us? When we say we, this is about 30 of us. So it is not just two people thinking up things. And it's 30 people who've been involved in this kind of work for many years, trying to suggest what can be done. Published before the election, in time for the Labour Party to have a look at, in particular for all those MPs in Labour who are never going to be in government because there aren't enough ministerial posts for them. So we thought maybe they might be interested in what their party could actually do when they're told that there is no alternative, that we just have to carry on the way we are. Act Now is costed. All the policies have actually got a price on them, and they've all been surveyed. And the thing which shocked me was how even in the Red Wall seats, all the policies get approval of the majority of voters. Because you constantly come across these people telling you this isn't possible. But the people who are telling you that it isn't possible are people who don't want you to even think that it might be possible. They want you to think about something else. Like there's little boats going across the channel that are going to wreck your life. Because, you know, you look around here and you can see the effects of the small boats and what it's done to Oxfordshire and how terrible it is. You know, it is utterly ridiculous, but it is easy to scare people senseless about things that will not affect them, to try to stop them realising that their life expectancy has fallen, that child mortality has risen for the first time in 70 years, that they are getting colder, cannot heat their homes, that their children are likely to live worse lives than they are. Don't worry about that. I look over there at the small boats. That's what you should worry about. The last flyer that went round is the book Seven Children, which comes out in September. And there's a story. There are more copies there from my able assistant with the mushroom hat. Is a story of the lives of seven typical children. You'll have to get the book if you want to know what seven typical children are like. By typical, I mean we take the 14 million children born in the UK in 2018. We divide them into seven groups. We divide them into the poorest 2 million, the next 2 million, up to the 2 million children whose parents have got the most money. We take the middle one of those 2 million. I won't spoil it for you, except a clue. Gemma is the name of the child who's typical of the best off seventh of all children. It is very unlikely that anybody in Gemma's circumstances is at this festival here, which may or may not come as a surprise. Gemma's mum and dad run a corner shop. They run it quite well, but they can't have a holiday with Gemma because one of them always has to work in the shop. That's your typical life of a rich kid in the UK today. They could just about afford to send Gemma and her sister private, but they'd have no money for anything else. But it really, really worries them because they want Gemma's future to be good. Okay? We can either carry on living with that kind of a world in which even the best of have anxiety, depression, fear, if the kids don't do really well, don't stay in the top 5%, you can't imagine what their future will be like, not even the grandchildren's kids. Or you can accept that this has failed, it's got to alter, it's going to alter. I'll end on your comment about taxation. We're often told that we have the highest taxation we've had for 70 years. This is true in the round of all taxation, but we still have the lowest taxation in Europe per capita, apart from Ireland and Switzerland, and they are faulty GDPs, explain why. We spend less on public goods than they spend in France, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Greece, in Switzerland, in Finland, in Norway, everywhere. That's why our schools are worse, why our hospitals are worse, why our housing system is worse, why we have the highest rates of homelessness, why our prisons are so full because our crime rates are so high. It doesn't have to be like this, but the group who have the most power to alter this are the best off. The key thing about the beverage report is the word beverage. Baron Beveridge was a liberal, misogynist, eugenicist, educated at, I think it was rugby school, born out in the Raj in what was then India, to a very rich family. He didn't like poor people very much, but things had to change in 1942. A coalition emerged of very well-off people and poorer people, trade unions and the elite at the time, to alter things. It wasn't just the Labour Party in 1945 that changed things. There was a realisation across the political spectrum that we couldn't carry on as we are. We couldn't have the charity hospitals and the private hospitals. We had to nationalise, we had to make education free and fairer than it had been and more equal. And we had to build more social housing than anywhere else in the world had done, so that the majority of children in 1946, 47, 48 were living in a council house at one time rather than in a slum.
Thank you. I'm just very sorry to say we've only got a few minutes left, so
let's
take a few at a time because we actually only have 3 minutes, very sadly. So could you just be really brief?
Thanks very much. You said in your introduction.
You said in your introduction that you had become aware that the UK was one of the most deeply divided countries in Europe, but also then said that there are only a few places left where you said stuffy academic environments where people celebrate the UK's history of colonialism. It doesn't seem to be a big majority versus a minority. It does, as you said previously, seem to be widely divided, with lots of people on both sides of ideological discussions in this country. I wanted to know what your strategy might be for creating a forum to have consensus and a meeting of minds, and take that process out of the hands of social media companies that intentionally generate division and conflict to sell adverts.
I think there's lots of ways that you can develop consensus, share knowledge, find out what people think. Citizens' assemblies are a really good move, where you bring people together, you can choose people to serve on them like you would choose for juries, so that they're representative of a community or a place. And then you can focus them on particular issues. You could ask questions that you wanted answered, and you could bring in different voices for that citizens' assembly to hear, and then they can vote on what they would like. That's a great way to make policy, I think, from the bottom up.
The other way is to question organisations like the BBC. So this morning the BBC had switched to saying two sides, there are two groups of protesters, the far right and the anti-fascists. Now, these riots are far right racist riots. There are a few groups of anti-fascists who are standing up against fascists, right? But the word anti-fascist is about stopping a really bad thing happening. And when the BBC starts presenting people who are against fascism as just a view you might have, you've got a problem. Who makes those decisions in the BBC? Some of them will be in this festival right now, because they have the salaries at the top of the BBC to afford to come here. And it's explaining to people at the top of the BBC that even-handed doesn't mean being stupid, even if you grew up in a very rarefied environment where you didn't mix with most normal people.
Okay, round of applause. We've actually run out of time. I'm really sorry. I know we could talk about this for a long time, but I wonder if you could just end on a very, very brief message of hope from both of you about how we can, a huge question, but reflections of hope for the future.
All right, so I'll go. Who do you think said it's our basic function to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes the politically inevitable? It was Milton Friedman. But I think that architect of neoliberalism had a thing about, he knew when it was a moment, you know, he knew how to grasp a moment. I think this is a moment, actually. We have a change of government, there are some open minds, we have some consensus, we can identify the problems. We could act now.
Michael, we're going to be signing books, you can ask us questions over in the book tent later. Mine's addressed to yours again over Hope. It's only 4 weeks since the election. It's the 4th of August today. Within 4 weeks of the election, we've gone from Rachel Reeve saying she wouldn't raise taxes to Rachel Reeve saying, oh, I think I'm going to have to raise taxes. Everything can change very, very quickly.
Thank you so much. Thank you.